Heute mal wieder zu Gast der Unternehmer, Professor, Digitalexperte, OMR-Bühnenstammgast, kann man fast sagen, Scott Galloway.
And so we have had no meaningful legislation in the United States whatsoever for what is the most valuable and most influential sector in the world, and that is technology. And at least in Europe, they're trying, because in Europe, we get a lot of upside from technology, from big tech in the United States. They create a lot of shareholder value, a lot of job growth. They create ecosystems of innovation. They've been very good for the U.S. economy. I think almost any nation in the world, if they said, okay, big tech can be headquartered here and we get all the problems, but they'll be headquartered here, I think they would accept that proposal. But in Europe, you get a lot of the downside, weaponization of your elections, income inequality, job destruction, depression of your teens, and you get a fraction of the upside. There aren't that many hospital wings or universities named after Google or Facebook billionaires in Europe. So you get all of the downside, but you get a fraction of the upside.
Let's go! Go! Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Weil die Kolleginnen und Kollegen von Instafo, also der Jobplattform für den Tech- und Sales-Bereich, von der ich hier schon häufiger berichtet habe, mittlerweile bei uns doch groß engagiert sind hier im Podcast. Ihr hört immer wieder hoffentlich von Instafo. Deswegen habe ich die Kollegen vor kurzem mal selber persönlich kennengelernt und war wirklich sehr angetan. Sie haben mir dazu erzählt, es gibt eine neue Finanzierungsrunde in die Firma. 10 Millionen werden da investiert. Das ganze Thema wird also immer relevanter. Daher nochmal hier mit Nachdruck der Hinweis: Wer Menschen sucht im Bereich Tech und Sales, denkt an Instafo. Die haben da scheinbar wirklich eine neue magische Soße gefunden, wo sie über ihre Plattform ein automatisiertes Matchmaking zwischen Arbeitnehmer und Arbeitgeber ermöglichen. Und das ist im direkten Marktvergleich dreimal effektiver, was die Quote von Bewerbung zu Einstellung angeht. Hilft natürlich auch, dass sie bereits über 100.000 passende Talentprofile auf der Plattform haben und dass man sehr, sehr schnell ins Gespräch kommt. Innerhalb von 48 Stunden bewerben sich die ersten Talente bei den Arbeitgebern, oder man kann sogar als Arbeitgeber einer vorselektierten Gruppe an Talenten aktiv eine Nachricht schicken oder sie zum Chatten einladen, um sich noch schneller kennenzulernen und zu prüfen, könnte das passen. Also nicht nur ich und die Geldgeber offensichtlich glauben an Instafo, sondern auch mittlerweile über 1.800 Firmen, darunter O2, RTL, HelloFresh, MyPoster, viele, viele weitere. Instafo ist auf OMR Reviews bestbewertet, 4,8 Sterne in der Kategorie Recruiting-Plattform. Firmen, die nun Instafo ausprobieren möchten, sehr gerne. Ihr spart außerdem 500 Euro auf die erste Besetzung, wenn ihr euch anmeldet über Instafo mit Doppel-F, instafo.com/OMR. Zurück zum Podcast. Vermutlich muss man wenigen OMR-Hörerinnen und Hörern Scott Galloway groß erklären, aber für die wenigen mache ich es natürlich gerne trotzdem. Und zwar ist Scott Galloway bei uns seit vielen Jahren regelmäßig Gast auf unseren Bühnen oder auch im Podcast. Das liegt daran, dass er seit vielen Jahren einfach ein sehr inspirierender Digitalbeobachter, selber auch Unternehmer ist, Professor ist an der NYU in New York, aber immer wieder einer der erfrischendsten und ungewöhnlichsten Beobachter des digitalen Treibens. Und auch genau darüber haben wir gesprochen, aber all die Fragen, die sich so gerade stellen in der digitalen Welt, natürlich besonders die mit Deutschlandbezug, bis hin zur Frage, wie eigentlich in den USA man auf Axel Springer guckt, all sowas. Scott Galloway, das muss man wirklich dazu sagen, hat verschiedenste Digitalfirmen gebaut, also ist keine reine Lehrmeinung, sondern ist von jemandem, der auch sehr investorenmäßig auf Dinge drauf guckt, der sogar schon mal Teil eines Konsortiums war, das die New York Times feindlich übernehmen wollte damals. Also sehr schillernde Person und irgendwo auch Inspiration. Ein Beispiel: Er schreibt jeden Freitag eine Mail, No Mercy, No Malice heißt die, die ich immer gerne lese, und selber aufgrund dieser Idee mir einen WhatsApp-Newsletter gebaut habe, der ganz anders ist, der auch freitags immer erscheint. Also wer Bock hat auf meinen WhatsApp-Newsletter, der kann sich einfach anmelden. Link in meiner Instagram-Bio oder hier in den Shownotes. Und natürlich kann man auch Scott Galloways Mailing unter No Mercy, No Malice einfach googeln, folgen. Aber am besten erstmal rausfinden, ob man ihm dann folgen möchte. Ich glaube schon. Jetzt geht's jedenfalls rein ins große Update mit Scott Galloway. Auf geht's! Hi.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
This time from London.
Yeah, we moved here about 8 months ago.
How come?
You know, it's the obvious questions that are difficult to answer. So a variety of things. We wanted to, just from a personal standpoint, we've always wanted to live in another country. I've never lived in another country. My kids have never lived in another country. I wanted to give them the exposure to something different. My parents are originally from the UK, so I've always felt a calling. I've always just loved Europe. And 5 years ago, we said, in 5 years, we're moving to Europe. And it comes around, and we moved. But I wouldn't say there was any kind of event, if you will. I think the honest answer is the reason we moved to London is because we can. We're blessed with the flexibility and the resources to do something wonderful. So we did it.
And is it going to be 1 year stint, or are you going to go back soon?
No, I don't think it'll be 1 year. We enrolled our kids in school here. So, and they really are enjoying school. And my oldest is in ninth grade. So I can't imagine pulling him out of school to go to a different school. And I can't imagine not living in the same country as him. So I would imagine we're here for at least 2 or 3 years. But, you know, you never know. When I moved to New York, I thought I'd be there for 3 years, and I was there 10 years. And then Florida was 10 years. So who knows? But I imagine we're here for at least a few years.
We have talked about this before, but I mean, many of the listeners probably don't know, but you have strong connections to Europe and especially Germany anyways, right?
Yeah, well, my wife was raised in Germany and considers herself German. And I've done a lot of work in Germany. You know, the reality is if I spoke German, we probably would have moved to Munich. I spend a lot of time in Germany. I love it there. And my wife is German. So yeah, we have strong connections with Germany.
So what's your perspective now after all this month in London and those ties on Europe and maybe especially on Germany? How do you see us?
Well, I mean, there's a big difference. It's sort of reductive to just say Europe, right? Because Greece is much different than Ireland, and the economies, the culture is just so different. I would say that other than just having really shitty weather, my observations of London are just the incredible density of wealth that has flowed in over the last several decades. I've been coming here 2 or 3 times a year since I was 5. And essentially, London has had a multi-trillion-dollar facelift because of private property laws that enable anyone with capital to come here, buy a house, and start, you know, doing business here. And whatever they bring in here is kind of untouchable by, you know, you can be a war criminal and kind of come to London and do your business here. And it's also established itself as sort of the jumping-off point to Europe. But the British, who seem to be outstanding at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, Brexit, from an outsider standpoint, every European nation has grown over the last 5 years except for the UK. And that is a direct function of Brexit. So it seems like things were just going a little too well for them, and they decided to fix that. Germany is, you know, Germany is just sort of, has always been kind of the engine of Europe. And what's always fascinated me about Germany is a reverence and respect for the middle class, whether it's vocational programming. 50% of people in Germany have some sort of vocational certification versus only 5% in the U.S. And there's some, you know, that's an amazing thing. And then even boards of directors, they mandate that a certain number of people on your board represent the workers. So the result is the income inequality hasn't been quite as extreme in Germany. The middle class has done better. You don't have the same number of billionaires. You don't have the same number of, you know, runaway successes. But it seems like it's more of a, I don't know, in many ways, a healthier model. Now, the downside to that is that because the downside isn't as great, that if you're a talented kid coming out of high school and you've got some abilities, go to get a vocational certification, go to work for an auto company, you're going to have a pretty decent life. Whereas in the U.S., the downside is much greater. You do not want to be without skills here in the U.S. My father, who immigrated from Europe, always said, America is a terrible place to be stupid. And what I think he meant was, it's a terrible place to be unmotivated because we don't have the same safety net here. The downside to that is entrepreneurship. The culture of entrepreneurship just isn't as strong in Germany, would be my assessment. If you think about Germany, I think it's about double the size or 50% greater than the UK economy, but the United Kingdom has more unicorns and probably, you know, a stronger startup scene in terms of, at least in terms of valuation. And so Germany, because of, I think, more of a risk aversion, more of a, it's a more honorable path towards the middle class, which on the whole, I think is a good thing, has resulted a lack of incentive to take the kind of risks you see in the UK, much less the US, and do startups. I've gotten to know the guys from Celonis, and I think right now they're the second most or the most valuable startup in Europe, and they'll probably be the biggest tech IPO in Europe for, you know, for a while, if and when it happens. It'll probably happen, I would guess, in 2024. But that could literally jumpstart or re-jumpstart the startup economy in Germany, because typically what happens is you have a company that goes public and creates billions or even hundreds of billions in wealth, and the people who register that wealth are fond of that city, so they stay there. They don't want to work 60 hours a week. They only want to work 40 hours a week, so they start a venture capital firm, and they start seeding all sorts of startups, and they create an ecosystem. It happened with Dell in Austin. It's obviously happened over and over in the U.S. and everywhere from Boston to, you know, North Carolina. There's kind of startups hubs that have emerged everywhere, but it hasn't happened a lot in Europe. So I think you're going to see probably not an explosion, but an increase in startups just based on a few companies that are doing very well in Germany.
So obviously you're following Celonis, a Munich-based company. Is that also the reason why Munich is your chosen city, or was your chosen city in case you spoke German?
No, I just met the guys from Celonis recently. I was just so blown away. I was forwarded their numbers in their pitch deck, and I was just so blown away by their numbers that I reached out to them and met with them just because I was interested in learning more about the company, because I want to understand more about the European tech system. The reason, you know, purely my interest in Munich is I just think Munich's one of the most beautiful, livable cities in the world. And I got very close or did a lot of work with the folks at Borda Media through the DLD conference, which I go to every year. But I just think Munich's a world, just from a lifestyle standpoint and a place to visit. I think Munich is one of the most livable cities in the world. And I think Hamburg is one of the coolest cities in the world. It's like Karl Lagerfeld exploded into a city. It's just the juxtaposition of, you know, you see an enormous crane and industry next to a beautiful, you know, 1,000 euro per square foot condominium in all glass. It's just, it's like Wallpaper Magazine turned into a city. It's a really unique city. And I enjoy
That's
Berlin.
Very kind of you.
I enjoy Berlin because I like World War II history. I just think it's fascinating. And it's obviously got a very, very kind of interesting startup scene. So yeah, I'm obviously a huge fan of Germany.
Any other German companies that you follow a little bit? I mean, maybe listed companies or private companies or whatever?
I'm trying to think. I mean, a little bit Zalando, just because they're in the e-commerce space. But I wouldn't say, you know, obviously SAP, the Dutch company, I forget what it's called, the chip maker that I think is the most valuable company in Europe. Mm-hmm. But I'm not very well versed in the German startup scene.
How about Axel Springer? I mean, German company that's trying to make some moves in the U.S. You know, Axel Springer, Matthias Döpfner, the CEO,
yeah,
who is like purchasing American publishing assets. Is that something you follow?
Yeah, I know Matthias, and I think he's a great leader. And I love the assets he bought. I think he bought Business Insider, which I think is a fantastic resource and something I enjoy. I think they also bought Politico. So,
yeah.
Yeah, Matthias is a visionary, a leader. Everyone said he was overpaying for these assets, and it ends up that they have paid off for him. It's kind of nice to see an iconic European company invading the U.S. versus vice versa. But yeah, I absolutely follow what Axel Springer does. And there just aren't that many traditional companies with traditional media roots who've been able to kind of make the leap to digital. So, and they're one of them. He's done a great job.
Did you notice that there's a lot of like public discussion here in Germany concerning his role, his opinions? There's stuff has come out. There's been reports about private SMS that he sent with like very controversial perspectives. Anything that came to your attention?
Yeah, I think that a lot of that is just gossip. I mean, you're speaking about the kind of the correspondence he had with Elon Musk. And
that's among other things, but that's one. But there's a couple others, like he had with the former editor in chief of Bild, the big tabloid. So yep. there's a lot going on right now here in Germany.
Yeah, look, the honest answer is I'm not that familiar with it. What I will say is that the media is fascinated by famous people, and is always looking for soft tissue to shed them in a poor light. Also, I will say that the media has a liberal bias, and when a CEO is not of that what I'll call woke culture, I think the media is more inclined to report on it, which is neither good nor bad. But I think Matthias got caught in sort of a, I think people expect people from media to be exceptionally progressive. And if they reflect anything but a progressive viewpoint, I think they get more scrutiny from other media outlets who are usually traditionally pretty progressive. But I don't know, unless you're doing something illegal, I kind of feel as if your texts are private, and, you know, it just feels kind of gossipy. I mean, I wonder when all my texts are going to come out, and I could imagine that people could, you know, make me look like, you know, shed me in a pretty poor light by cherry picking certain communications.
What's your perspective on this progressive or woke culture in general? I mean, I read an article in the Rolling Stone magazine a couple of days ago that says, like, what they call woke companies seem to be more successful, even despite the fact that there was expected for them to be less successful. Now it seems the opposite might be true, but it's a very random sample. There's a lot of discussion about that, and it's not very clear what woke means, but I'm sure you have an opinion on that.
I mean, it's a complicated topic because I consider myself a progressive. I think, you know, the basics around women's rights, women having choice, making an effort and investing in a society where people from different backgrounds who traditionally haven't had the same access or the same opportunities, that is worth investing and fighting for. And I think most progressive values come from what I'll call a good place. There's definitely instances where it's gotten out ahead of itself. Universities where students or faculty are shamed if they don't demonstrate progressive values. You know, 97% of the faculty at Harvard self-identify as Democrats. And universities are supposed to be places of provocative thought. And what my colleague Jonathan Haidt describes is everyone's barking up the same tree, that everyone's kind of supposed to sign up for a narrative that is usually a very progressive narrative. And if they're not, they're seen as quote-unquote dangerous. And that is especially upsetting in a university environment where the whole point of a university is to be provocative and say, quite frankly, what might seem at the time to be offensive things. Companies that are, I think there's a difference between correlation and causation. Younger people are more progressive, traditionally speaking, in urban cities. And so the companies that have added the most shareholder value tend to be technology companies, which tend to be younger and tend to be located in urban centers. So they just are going to initially draw from a talent pool that is more progressive. So I don't know if it's their progressive values that is driving good outcomes or just the fact that they attract people that are more progressive to begin with. Where I think companies sometimes make a mistake is I tell young people to not bring your whole self to work. I don't think you should really discuss politics at work. And I think when CEOs start discussing progressive politics at work, that oftentimes they're more virtue signaling than they are really willing to place resources around this. And unfortunately, what it does is it trains employees, especially younger employees, that their political views have a role at the company. And I don't think that's true. I think corporations or organizations or legal entities that are constructed to help people establish economic security for them and their families and their beliefs and their activities outside of work are their own and shouldn't fall under the scrutiny of the organization. And if you want to join the NRA or you want to protest, protest whatever cause it is you're upset about or protest in favor of it, I think that's your business. But I think it's gotten to the point where companies now feel as if they need to take a stand politically. And a lot of people at the company feel like to express their political viewpoint is their right. And I think it's their right, but I don't think it's appropriate in a lot of instances. I think that I think it's dangerous to have a company where people are expected to sign up for a certain political ideology. I think that's very personal. I think people should be able to have the political viewpoint they want, and that a corporation, for the most part, is there to create economic value and economic security for its employees. So I wonder if it's just gone a little too far.
I mean, you recently experienced some kind of, it looked like at least, controversy involving Twitter. I mean, it seemed like your Twitter account, which is quite large, was shut down.
Yeah, but to be fair, I don't know if it was shut down or that so many people have been laid off that when I couldn't get in and I sent in a customer service form or complain, that they just don't have the people to respond. I don't, to be honest, I don't know if I'm important enough that Elon Musk would take the effort to ban me. So I think
he noticed you. I mean, he knows who you are. He's I mean, you add a critical perspectives quite frequently on him, and he responded to some of them already. So he must know.
Yeah, he does know me, and he's called me names on Twitter. But I don't know. I think the most obvious, you know, Occam's razor, which is the most obvious explanation, is oftentimes the right explanation. And I think the most obvious explanation here is there was a technical glitch. I wasn't able to log into my account. I filled out several forms online saying I can't log in. And it took them 2.5 weeks to fix the issue, which is, when you lay off 80% of your staff, it's understandable or logical that customer service would degrade substantially. So that is what I would guess happened. I don't think it was some Machiavellian effort to keep me off of the platform.
Okay. Okay. Well, what's your current perspective on Twitter? I mean, it looked very problematic in the first place. Now it seems like they're maybe getting the turnaround to go.
I don't know. I think it's been a total disaster. He purchased it for $44 billion. When the debt starts trading, he raised $13 billion in debt. Supposedly the debt, when it starts trading or when the banks try and sell it, it might trade for 50 or 60 cents. And if the debt trades at 50 or 60 cents, what the market is saying is that debt gets their money back first if the company goes bankrupt. So if the market thought the company was worth $13 billion right now, those bonds could be sold at 100 cents on the dollar because they get their money back first. So if they go out at 50 or 60 cents on the dollar, where the market is saying the company's worth $6 to $7 billion, and he paid, what, 40, 44 billion or 42 yep. billion just 8 months ago. So in terms of value destruction, I don't think you've ever seen this type of value destruction this quickly. And a lot of it is self-inflicted injuries. The company has lost somewhere between 60 and 70% of its ad revenues. And that's not because of the economy. That's not because they don't like the ad stack or they don't like the product. It's because they don't like Elon Musk and what they feel is really reckless behavior. And so these are totally self-inflicted wounds. And I don't know if you saw the BBC interview, but he claims he's kind of positioned himself as saving it from bankruptcy. This was a company not headed towards bankruptcy. I mean, it wasn't making money. In some years, it was cash flow negative. But it had a $30, $35 billion market cap. It could have easily... And it didn't have any debt. So it was not a financially strained company. By coming in and behaving in what a lot of people felt was a reckless manner, you know, advertisers abandoned the platform en masse, and he put it into financial duress. So, and now he's claiming, it's like starting a fire in your backyard and you pick up a hose and you call yourself a hero. So this is a company that he has dramatically downsized. There's been very little product innovation. The subscription product is not working. I think he has demonstrated a side of himself that is really ugly. I think it's going to hurt Tesla. I sold my Tesla. I think there are a lot of people who are less inclined to purchase a Tesla now because of his antics in action. And at just about the same time, a bunch of great electric vehicles are coming on the market, including, you know, the i7 from BMW, or the Mercedes electric car is incredible. Volkswagen's coming for, you know, the electric market. So I think Twitter has been an unmitigated disaster for Elon Musk. I can't. And anyone who trusted him and invested in this thing, has seen basically their capital go up in smoke. This is already probably the second worst acquisition in history, just behind AOL's acquisition of Time Warner.
Do you feel like that Silicon Valley in general has changed in recent years? I mean, the people that seem to run Silicon Valley, if you want, and the most dominant media outlets that we here in Germany, the digital interested people, they now listen to the All In podcast, for instance. There's all kinds of new voices coming out of Silicon Valley. It seems like there's a change going on a little bit. How do you see that?
Yeah, there's definitely, I feel as if the Valley has kind of bifurcated into venture capitalists who see themselves as part of a larger whole, see themselves as citizens. You know, it was really kind of came to light in the Silicon Valley Bank crisis. And that is, you had hundreds of venture capitalists who put together a letter saying they would support the bank and maintain their funds there, trying to facilitate an elegant, orderly acquisition because they saw the bank and the role the bank played as being important, and they didn't want to see contagion spread through the banking system. And what was more interesting than the venture capitalists who signed that letter was the venture capitalists who did not sign it. And those venture capitalists, many of them have big investments in crypto and Web3 technologies that to a certain extent benefit when America or the banking system is under stress or duress. And I call this group of people venture catastrophists. And some of them were on Twitter. They have very large followings in all caps saying that there would be lines around the banks. Most people would not get their money back, that the correct response here was that you should be terrified. And they were creating, they were not only going into a crowded theater, but a crowded stadium and screaming fire. And what in the U.S., our most patriotic citizens are veterans, people who have served in uniform. And what strikes me as really disappointing is some of our most blessed Americans, specifically people who have typically got very good educations, have access to the most robust technology and financing ecosystem in the world, have aggregated enormous wealth, which translates to enormous influence, but they don't seem to be very patriotic. They would rather see the banking system go down such that their Bitcoin investments go up. They talk about their kind of bunkers and plans to either colonize Mars or go take us into the metaverse, as opposed to taking their genius and their capital and trying to make the, you know, the planet we're on more habitable. So I think there's sort of this venture catastrophist, libertarian, anti-American vein running through technology that's very disappointing, that you would think that these people would feel more loyalty and gratitude towards the United States, as opposed to sort of betting on its demise and constantly, you know, I say shitposting America. You know, Elon Musk says his general view is that government should just get out of way, and he's openly disdainful of government. Meanwhile, he's taken billions of dollars from the government, whether it's for charging stations or for a $350 million loan for his company when it was not doing well, his NASA contracts. I mean, he has taken more money from the government than most companies. And at the same time, he'll call for a pause on AI because of the risks it presents. And then it comes out that he's, in fact, buying all sorts of equipment to try and implement AI at Twitter, and that he's incorporated to do a new startup at Twitter, a new startup in AI. It just feels as if this community has not done itself any favors, that there's a general feeling that they're not very patriotic. And they're not concerned that their interests have diverged from the interests of, you know, kind of the broader well-being of the United States.
Would you say that Elon Musk, for instance, net is positive for society, for the world, or negative?
I think he's a positive. I think that I don't think you can. I think you have to acknowledge that he inspired the EV race. And the world is better off for that. We're going to reduce carbon emissions in America, mostly because of the climate bill that Biden passed. But, you know, Germany, which makes, in my view, the best cars in the world, has Elon Musk has absolutely, you know, motivated German automakers to go much faster towards EVs. He's motivated the entire planet to move towards EVs. That's a huge positive for the world. Space exploration, I think, or not even space exploration, but space hauling is a big positive for the world. It creates a lot of value, a lot of shareholder value. So I would say it's a net positive. I feel the same way about tech. The problem is with the word net, and that is fossil fuels have been a net positive for the world, but we still have emission standards. Pesticides have been a net positive for the world, but we still have regulation around, you know, the Food and Drug Administration. What we don't do around technology or someone like Elon Musk is we've decided they're either good or bad, and you have to be all in and worship them or think they're evil, as opposed to the definition of intelligence is you can hold two thoughts in your mind at the same time. And that is you can acknowledge his incredible talent, the good he's done, and acknowledge that he deserves a lot of rewards for it. I think he's the second or third wealthiest man in the world. But at the same time, hold him accountable when he starts accusing his employees of sex crimes, which is just not true. You know, hold him accountable when he circulates misinformation around violence against the husband of the Speaker of the House here in the United States, speculating that it was some sort of gay scandal. These statements create put these people in tangible danger. They ruin people's lives, or they make their lives much harder. And when you're an individual who is of this powerful, you would expect them to behave more responsibly. You would expect them to acknowledge or at least recognize the power they have and show a little bit more grace and, quite frankly, just a little bit more maturity. So is he a net positive? Yes. Has he done ridiculously reckless, childish, stupid things? Yes. And I think we can hold both of those thoughts in our mind at the same time.
Zu Lea Kramer muss ich eigentlich nichts mehr sagen. Sie ist eine der inspirierendsten Frauen der deutschen Digitalwirtschaft. Sie war schon häufiger hier im Podcast. Sie hat ihren eigenen Podcast Fast and Curious. Und weil sie am Ende selber sagt, es gibt zu wenige Lea Kramers. Es gibt auch zu wenige CEOs in DAX-Konzernen. Die Frauen sind übrigens nur eine von 40. Damit sich das ändert, weil das Lea ein Anliegen ist, hat sie neben all ihren Aufgaben die 10 More In Akademie gegründet oder ein Online-Programm aufgesetzt, explizit für Frauen, die da ihre Führungsfähigkeit, ihre Führungskräfte entwickeln sollen. Sie hilft dabei ganz aktiv. Es geht um 6 Wochen, einen 6-wöchigen Online-Kurs, der jetzt im Mai wieder startet, den ich euch Hörerinnen ans Herz lege, hier im Namen von Lea. Guckt euch das an. Man braucht lediglich 2 Jahre Berufserfahrung, unabhängig vom aktuellen Arbeitsumfeld, in dem man sich befindet. Es ist sowohl möglich als Angestellte, als Selbstständige, als Gründerin in Elternzeit. Und man muss auch noch gar keine Führungsverantwortung haben aktuell. Man muss sich nur für das Thema interessieren und weiterkommen wollen. Dann ist 10 More In der richtige Ort. Schaut euch bitte im Netz natürlich vor allen Dingen an, aber auch gerne bei uns beim Festival am 7. und 8. Mai ist 10 More In mit einem eigenen Stand vor Ort. Lea persönlich natürlich auch am Stand, aber auch auf den Bühnen. Also es gibt viele Möglichkeiten. Die einfachste ist 10 More In, ein Wort, 10 More In, ein Wort.com/OMR.
Zurück zum Podcast.
Speaking of regulation, I'm always surprised when you praise European regulation. It has happened quite frequently recently. You seem to be quite a fan of what the EU does.
Well, you're trying. I mean, think about it. The auto industry there's massive regulation. Airbags, you know, any car you put on the road has to pass all kinds of safety standards, crash tests. There's regulations in terms of when you have to do a recall. I mean, there's all sorts of it. There's emission standards. The pharmaceutical industry has enormous regulation. I've served on the boards of restaurant companies. Once you have more than a certain number of outlets or restaurants, you have to disclose the calories. Any consumer product has to go through testing and have certain labeling requirements. All of those industries are dwarfed by value and by influence. As registered by the technology sector. And there hasn't been any regulation whatsoever in the tech industry in the United States, because in the United States, essentially, we've gone to sort of pay for play. And that is the fastest growing expense line at technology companies isn't AI. It isn't, you know, anything, you know, around supply chain. It's around lobbying. And so we have had no meaningful legislation in the United States whatsoever for what is the most valuable and most influential sector in the world, and that is technology. And at least in Europe, they're trying, because in Europe, we get a lot of upside from technology, from big tech in the United States. They create a lot of shareholder value, a lot of job growth. They create ecosystems of innovation. They've been very good for the U.S. economy. I think almost any nation in the world, if they said, okay, big tech can be headquartered here and we get all the problems, but they'll be headquartered here, I think they would accept that proposal. But in Europe, you get a lot of the downside, weaponization of your elections, income inequality, job destruction, depression of your teens, and you get a fraction of the upside. There aren't that many hospital wings or universities named after Google or Facebook billionaires in Europe. So you get all of the downside, but you get a fraction of the upside. Now, what that ratio or that asymmetry has done is it stiffened the backbone of EU regulators who've said, okay, we're gonna have some sort of an attempt at data regulation. I would argue that GDPR has not worked. It's worked in the sense that you've shown you can pass regulation, but I think it's actually hurt small and medium-sized media companies more than the big ones. It's almost as if the legislation was crafted by the big ones. It's hurt their competitors, I think, more than it's hurt them. But there is different legislation coming out of Europe. They're not afraid to fine them. I'm not even sure Mark Zuckerberg can go to the UK right now. I think there's a summons for him to appear before the House of Commons. But you're at least trying. Europe is at least acknowledging that there needs to be regulation, that these companies need to be reined in. In the United States, all regulation here around big tech has kind of died a slow death. It gets moneyed away, if you will. And that's by Democrats and Republicans. So I think Europe is at least trying and has been, you know, has passed more legislation, more regulation in the United States.
In the past 12 months, for the first time, those big American tech companies, Google, Amazon, Meta, Apple, they have declined in value. It's something new. It's never happened in the past decade. And is that only because of interest rates, or do you see a bigger pattern behind that?
Well, these companies, any market is cyclical. And when you have a growth company that's eating cash because it's growing so fast, the cost of that cash, when it goes up, it's more expensive to finance the company. And then because they're growth companies whose cash flows are increasing, those future cash flows are worth less because they get discounted back at a higher rate. So more expensive to finance cash flows that are worth less. The entity that takes that double 1-2 punch is the stock price. So growth companies are especially vulnerable to an increase in interest rates. We have seen an unprecedented velocity of an increase in interest rates over the last 15, 16 months. So obviously, growth companies are going to get hit very hard. And a lot of these companies have seen their revenues growth decelerate. So it's sort of a perfect storm. But I think it's healthy. I some of these companies just became overvalued. But some, you know, the last 3 months, you've seen a lot of them come back. I think Facebook or Meta has doubled in value over the last 3 or 4 months. So I just think it's a natural, healthy part of the cycle that the sector, you know, no sector can go up forever. It corrected pretty viciously in 2022. It's come back a decent amount in Q1 of 2023. And obviously the AI is potentially a disruptive technology. So they're wondering, you know, companies are susceptible to that. But also, you know, the healthy part of capitalism is it forces you to make hard decisions. And a lot of these companies have basically embraced layoffs. That's probably, you know, in terms of ground level change, that's probably the biggest change in tech over in 2023 is just the amount of layoffs. And that's largely been inspired, or to a certain extent, inspired by what Musk has done at Twitter. I mean, he's laid off 80% of the employees. And granted, if you can't get on the platform, it takes them 2.5 weeks to get back to you now. But most people wouldn't know that 80% of the employees are no longer there. I mean, the product's still working. And I think almost every tech company has had a meeting where they've said something along the following: how do we lay off 20 or 30% of our staff, because the majority of the expenses are people, while holding on to all of the revenues, unlike Musk? And you're seeing that across every tech company. And every time they announce a layoff, the stock price goes up. And ultimately, what drives strategy at any for-profit company is not the revenues, not what's good for the world, but how senior management gets compensated. And the majority of companies, senior management gets compensated disproportionately based on the value of the stock. So as long as the market keeps rewarding these companies for laying off employees, you're going to see more and more layoffs.
What's the end game for TikTok going to be, at least in the US or in Europe? What do you think?
I think TikTok probably gets spun, because I do think the US, there's a lot of momentum around banning it. Even if it's states, the state of Montana here has actually banned TikTok. And there's now proposed legislation that will give the Commerce Department here in the United States the ability to ban it outright, which, by the way, I think is probably regulatory overreach, but that's a different show. But I think there's going to be probably a spin because there's so much money involved here. This is a company that could be the next trillion-dollar market cap company. But if it does start to get banned state by state, or there's federal regulation to ban it in the U.S., that'll take the value down 80-90% because this is their biggest market. So I think on the eve of what I'll call a banning, or if the state-by-state ban continues to get momentum, I think that ByteDance, under the direction or the approval of the CCP, will decide to spin it so they can hold on to the shareholder value. I think that they were hoping they could hold on to the, you know, have their cake and eat it too, hold on to the shareholder value and maintain what ultimately might be a great propaganda tool that they have influence over. When they see that the latter is no longer a possibility and that it risks the whole business, I think they will agree to some sort of spin. So I think the way it plays out is as we get closer and closer to a potential ban, ByteDance, with the approval of the CCP, decides to spin it and make it an independent company with American government and some American investors.
Okay, okay. Talk a little bit about AI. I mean, there's so much talk in ChatGPT. You use it frequently for your own, I don't know, whatever, private purposes, services, anything you do with it? I mean, what's your thinking on that?
I'm experimenting with it. I'm trying to get used to it just to learn about it. I'm writing a book, and I use it occasionally for research for the book, and I'm just like everyone
what's
else.
What's the book going to be about? A new Galloway book coming out. Okay, I didn't know that. What's the book going to be about?
It's called The Algebra of Wealth, Strategies for Economic Security. I'm basically writing a personal finance book. But it's just an unbelievably powerful research tool. And today, I think I started playing with on GitHub. I started playing with something called, I think it's called AutoGPT. But what it does is it'll jump across different large language models and perform multiple tasks. So if you say, arrange a college tour for my 18-year-old of U.S. universities in the Southeast, it will first decide when colleges are holding college tours. Then it'll look into flights. Then it'll ask you what dates make the most sense for you. In other words, it starts thinking about the next step, and it will look to the best large language models to get a specific task done. So it's almost sort of like sequential, whereas right now, AI has been about specific kind of singular questions. You get an answer to, and then you go on to the next one. This one is assuming or trying to make an estimate of what the next question it would need to answer for you to arrange a college tour for your daughter. I think it's enormously powerful. I don't think AI is going to take your job. I think someone who understands AI will take your job. I think this is going to turn people into, you know, information warriors. I think it'll grow the economy. I'm actually quite optimistic about it. And if you look at the history of technological innovation, there's a lot of catastrophizing at the outset, and there is some job loss, but ultimately over time, almost any technology creates more jobs than it destroys. And I think that's the same thing here. I'm also a bit cynical about the calls to pause AI. You know, I would argue we can see much more visible readily apparent damage from social media on our teenagers, but nobody called for a pause on social media. And also I'm sort of cynical. We're talking about Elon Musk. He signed the letter calling for a pause on AI. Meanwhile, he's been, trying to massively increase AI functionality at Twitter and supposedly starting his own AI company. So I think the genie's out of the bottle. I'm not as worried about it as some people. I think it's going to be fantastic. I don't want to pause it because I'm worried that the Chinese, the Iranians, and the Russians won't pause. And I think whoever understands that technology, the same way the countries that best understood manufacturing and assembly line technology or understood the internet or understood data grew their economies faster. But I see a lot of upside here. I'm actually really excited about it. Unfortunately, it's another technology I have to figure out. And as you get older, it just gets harder and harder to figure this shit out. I think the catastrophizing here is just that. It's catastrophizing. I think it's going to be a net positive. That doesn't mean we don't need regulation. I'm hoping that the government gets much more serious across border standard protocols, assembles a group of people who really understand it, to ensure it doesn't get away from us the same way social media got away from us. But I would say I'm more optimistic than most people about AI.
To go full circle and also just mentioned catastrophizing, I wanted to ask you if the whole discussion around climate change, is that rightfully so catastrophizing, or is that also exaggerated?
No, I'm not an environmentalist. I think that the world, when the last human takes her last breath, I think the earth is going to belch for 50 years and be just fine. I think the earth is going to be just fine. It's us that are going to perish. And I consider myself a man of science. And if you consider yourself a person of science, you just can't ignore what's happening. You know, the oceans are up 1.2 Celsius. And once they get over 2 or 2.5, we're going to have a series of extreme weather events that will just be, for lack of a better term, disastrous. 7 of the 10 largest super fires in the history of California have happened in the last 10 years. So the thing that I think is incorrect about climate change is we're all hoping that we're just going to solve it by making a lot of money, that some kid at a dorm at MIT or, you know, Cologne University or wherever is going to come up with some technology and we'll be able to invest in it and it'll solve climate change and we'll make a lot of money. I don't think that's true. I think it's going to be very expensive. It's going to require real sacrifice on the part of major European and U.S. economies and China. It's going to require incredible cross-border cooperation. But yeah, I think it's an existential threat. And I think that I'm very heartened by the climate change act that was passed here in the U.S. It's supposedly going to reduce carbon emissions in the U.S. by 40% by 2030, which I think is a big step forward. But no, I don't. I think it's very real and very serious. And I'm just so disappointed that it got politicized. For some reason, people see that climate change activism is somehow a progressive issue or a liberal issue, whereas in the U.S., it was Republicans who were actually environmentalists in the beginning, initially Teddy Roosevelt. So no, I think it's a huge threat. I'd love to see Germany restart their nuclear power plants. I'd love to see us get more serious about nuclear and much more serious around carbon credits and the like. Yeah, I think it is the threat that people say it is.
Anything you do there personally, any way you engage against climate change?
That's a fair question. I think more about my footprint. When I lived in the U.S., I owned a plane and I did carbon offsets and I actually sold my plane for a variety of reasons, including I was much more conscious of my carbon footprint. I'll never own an internal combustion engine car again, EV. So I would say I'm much more cognizant of it and trying to take my carbon footprint to zero and then play offense and have my family's carbon footprint be negative. But more than anything, I vote for people who are not climate change deniers. That to me is a disqualifying issue because it means that you're just trying to be, you either are stupid or you've decided that a way to inflame people or get a group of passionate people on the far right is to gaslight the left by denying climate change. So for me, it's an issue that if somebody doesn't acknowledge the problem and isn't willing to pass laws and take it very seriously, I would never vote for them.
Ihr seid ja hoffentlich alle am 7. und 8. Mai beim OMR-Festival in Hamburg mit dabei. Das freut dann nicht nur mich, sondern auch die Kolleginnen und Kollegen von Audi. Denn unser Partner Audi bietet dort die Möglichkeit, Audi und vor allen Dingen Elektromobilität zu erleben oder zu erfahren, im wahrsten Sinne des Wortes. Ihr könnt dort den Audi Q6 e-tron, der Mitte März erst seine Weltpremiere gefeiert hat, dort kennenlernen. Ihr könnt Probefahrten machen, verschiedensten vollelektrischen Modellen wie dem Audi Q4 e-tron, all die Fahrzeuge sind vor Ort. Um das zu machen, benötigt ihr noch nicht mal, ganz leise, ein Ticket fürs Festival. Ihr könnt einfach unter audi.de/omr schon vorab eine Probefahrt reservieren oder wenn ihr ein Ticket habt, dann könnt ihr zum Audi-Stand kommen in die Halle A4 und dort eine Probefahrt ausmachen. Jedenfalls kombiniert gerne eure Reise zum Festival nach Hamburg mit dem Erleben von Vorsprung durch Technik. Zurück zum Podcast. You just mentioned your newest book, and apparently it's about investing or how to gain financial security for young people. Can you share a little bit about how you invest these days? I mean, I know that you make a business angel or early stage investments, but also public investments. And one of your investments I learned is a German guy living in New York that you invested in.
A German guy living in New York.
Public.com.
Oh, Public. Yeah. I've invested.
Life.
Yeah, he's a talented entrepreneur. Yeah, so I think there is an algorithm to building wealth. And I think it's, in a very reductive way, it's the following. It's focus. It's finding something you're good at and something that people will pay you for. And that's not easy. That's what most people try to figure out through most of their 20s, is having empathy for themselves. What do they enjoy? What are they good at? But also having empathy for the world. And that is, why should the world care that you're good at something? That you need to find something that people will pay you for. And then once you figure that out, a certain level of stoicism and discipline, and that is simply put, wealth is not a function of how much you make, it's a function of how much you save so you can invest. So having the discipline to avoid all the incredible capitalist offers put in front of you, whether it's an upgrade to business class or cool Air Jordans or you know, trying to impress a date by taking to an expensive restaurant, having a discipline to spend less than you make such that you can develop capital, establish a capital base and start investing. And then three, diversification. No five stocks in the S&P, if you've held them for 10 years, that portfolio has never lost money. Every day, it's a coin flip. Basically, 48% of stocks go down, 52% go up. But over the long term, if you own five stocks in the S&P over 10 years, 100% of the time, that portfolio goes up in value. So diversification is incredibly important. And then finally, time, and that is investing for the long term. Don't day trade, low fees, and you can become, you know, with if you employ those four things, you can become wealthy. And the bad news or the good news is I know how to get you rich. The bad news is the answer is slowly. And I think it's a series of behaviors, but I think the algorithm is pretty straightforward. And it's not, you don't need to know which companies to invest in. You don't have to have the right contacts. What you need to show is a series of characteristics and behaviors that have resulted in wealth creation across ethnicities, demographies, demographics, cultures. And I go through each of those four things and talk about how do you figure out what it is you want to do? What does it mean to have the type of discipline to save money? And then some basics around understanding finance and markets such that you can invest wisely.
But I mean, your personal portfolio, I mean, sometimes you share like a little glimpse of it here and there, and I pick it up and I'm always surprised. It's. I mean, obviously, you seem to be like worth a couple hundred million from my outside-in perspective. So it's a different style of investment. I get that. But what is your personal style right now, given you're in that position?
For me, it's diversification. For me, it's trying to find things that aren't connected. And it's very hard. So diversification as a concept was adopted in the 80s, and institutions listened and started diversifying. And so the problem is if an iron ore company in Australia goes out of business, it impacts an institutional investor in Dubai who might need liquidity, so they need to sell their Airbnb stock. So everything's now kind of more connected than it used to be. But my investment strategy now is one, I have special access that most people don't have. I get invited on boards. I'm asked to be an advisor. In exchange for that, I get access to great private company deals. I can co-invest with private equity firms and VCs. And in addition to not having to pay fees, I can get additional equity. So I have an advantage that most people don't have. I'm very privileged that way. So for me, investing in specific companies kind of makes sense. For most people, it does not. For most people, the best strategy is to invest in an ETF or an index fund. It's very low fees, and quite frankly, not think about it, and then diversify as much as they can. My investment strategy right now is diversification. So the last few investments I've made have been in an energy company in Switzerland, a jet engine leasing company Central Florida. And, you know, right now I'm looking at an aircraft maintenance company in El Salvador. I am trying to find, you know, I've been wealthy several times, and I've lost most or all of it several times. And I'm at a stage now where I can't make it back. So your Kevlar is diversification. And that is, nobody knows with most investments what's going to happen. And if you take a bullet, if it goes really badly, when you're wearing Kevlar and your Kevlar is diversification, it hurts, but it doesn't kill you. So my strategy right now is to take advantage of my privilege, which most people don't have, and co-invest with great investors at better rates than most people and get opportunities most people don't have. But more than anything, I'm trying to diversify and make sure that if tech goes way down, I'm in an energy company. You know, I'm trying to invest in different parts of the economy, different parts of the world that aren't as connected. And the other thing is I'm also switching to fixed income, where I'm slowly but transitioning out of a lot of equities and for the first time in my life, investing in bonds, because I think for the first time in probably, 15 or 20 years, you get rewarded for the risk you're taking with bonds. Whereas before you really didn't get much yield for the risk you were taking with bonds. So I'm moving to a different part of my life where I'm not about making money, I'm about not losing it.
How do you source these deals? I mean, it sounds like you must have wealthy friends across the world that like point those deals out to you and offer for you to join them on those deals, or how does it happen? I mean, El Salvador, Switzerland, it seems like quite random from the outside.
Yeah, it's not friends as much as it is. People will see my work and say, we'd be interested in having you on the board or on the advisory board. And I say, well, I'd be interested, but only if I can invest. Or a VC fund will say, we think you could help us with this company. Would you be interested in investing alongside of us? And I will do that. But it's not like an insider clubby thing. It's not like an insider clubby thing where I get, you know, a friend that I'm playing golf with gives me access. It's a fund or a company that reaches out and says, we'd like to get you involved. And, you know, I didn't have this access until I'd been working for 30 years. And so I've just recently in the last 5 years gotten this type of access. And if I like the company and I like their mission, I like the founders, I'll invest. But I never invest more than 3% of my net worth in any one thing. Because as strong as you feel about something, you just never know. There's a randomness to all of it. But most of my access or my privilege comes from because of the work I've done, because of some of the footprint I have, because of what I generously people think might be some domain expertise. I get opportunities to get involved with companies, private companies, and the way I get involved is I invest.
And so usually you write like $1-2 million tickets?
Yeah, it's anywhere from, you know, occasionally a couple of kids will approach me and I like them and I'll, you know, throw 50 or 100 grand at it. But my investments have been as big as 10 million and stuff that is lower risk. More later stage, lower risk stuff. But yeah, I would say the average ticket size is kind of 1-3 million.
What's your most powerful outlet, communication outlet right now? Is it your newsletter? Is it your podcast? I mean, you're a public figure basically, but on what distribution channel do you stand mostly?
So kind of my first love is my newsletter, No Mercy, No Malice, that I've been putting out every Friday for the last 6 or 7 years. You know, that takes the most time, and writing is difficult. You know, what we're doing here, once we stop recording, we're done, right? But writing, you have to be thoughtful. You have to really think through what you're saying, find the right data, fact check. So that is sort of the center for my content. The thing that has the most reach are my podcasts, because literally millions of people hear them over the course of a month. But the... And then the thing that is probably gives you the most credibility are books. I try and put out a book about every 18 or 24 months. And then I would say the kind of the lowest calorie return is TV. TV feels good and it's fun to see yourself on the TV and your kids are impressed by it. But I find in terms of actual return on investment, it's the lowest. So my first love is the newsletter. It's what I do. It's the hardest thing I do. Books I do for, you know, more as like just to test myself and keep up on stuff. And in terms of reach... podcasts.
And is podcasting like a growing medium, you think? It's still like the beginning. I mean, you recently wrote in your newsletter, which I highly recommend. I think 3-4 weeks ago, you sounded very bullish on podcasting. And it seemed like, I mean, luckily for us, we're still in the early innings of podcasting.
Yeah, podcasting. So there's huge inequality or there's a huge Gini coefficient in podcasting. And that is, there's 1.6 million podcasts, and the reality is probably only 200 to 500 make money. It's incredibly competitive, and I would bet the top 100 podcasts do 200% of the profits, meaning everyone outside of the 200 loses money. They do it for marketing reasons. Or they do it because it's a passion, or they use it as a means of bringing attention to another business line. So there's incredible inequality in podcasting. But at the same time, every year it grows. It's still working from a very small base. I only think it's about, $1.5 billion or $2 billion in advertising right now. But it's growing. And there are very few mediums that are growing double digits each year, which podcasting is. So that's the good news. It's growing. It's also got very low barriers of entry. Which is both good and bad. That's why there's 1.6 million of them. Once you get to break even, though, they can become very profitable because they're not resource heavy. And I imagine with AI, they're going to get even less resource heavy. So for me, it's been, it started as a passion. I started doing them about 5-6 years ago. but they've actually become very, you know, they're small businesses, but they're hugely profitable. If you can build a $2 or $3 million podcast business, you're probably clearing $2 million a year. Because once you get above, you know, a certain number, you know, there's 70 or 80 points of gross margin. So I'm very bullish on it, but keep in mind, it's still a pretty small medium.
And but it's going to grow. I mean, your outlook is quite optimistic.
Oh, yeah. It's just, if you look at where people are spending time, they're spending much more time. They're spending a lot of time on podcasts. It's grow, you know, basically dollars catch time. And the reason you knew the internet was going to grow 20 years ago is it was capturing so much more people's attention than actual dollars spent. So over time, attention foots to dollars spent. And the amount of attention that people or time people are spending on podcasts is growing double digits every year. So I'm still very bullish. It's very competitive though. It's a, you know, it's kind of like that joke, what do you call two white guys? And the answer is a podcast. I mean, everybody, you know, everybody's doing a podcast right now. So, but if you're good at it, stick with it. You know, I don't think we were profitable at Prof G, our podcast, until the second or third year. But once you go profitable, it becomes very profitable. Every incremental dollar is 80 or 90 cents of gross margin. So anyways, yeah, I'm very bullish on it.
I mean, you have, if I count them correctly, you have 5 podcasts a week, right? I mean, there's 2 Pivot with Kara, and then there's a couple of different that you put under the Prof G brand, correct?
That's exactly right. Yeah, our podcasts combined reach about 2 million people a month. So it's, I love the medium. It's something I enjoy a great deal. I'm very bullish on it. I think it's a ton of fun. And what's interesting about it is the medium is the message. If somebody comes up to me and high fives me, if a bike messenger high fives me and says, Prof G, love your stuff, I know they've seen a video. If someone comes up to me and wants to have a really thoughtful conversation, I know they've read a newsletter or my book. But if someone just comes up to me and starts speaking to me as if they're my friend, I know it's the podcast. Because when you're in someone's ears physically with AirPods, which is how most people listen to podcasts now, they feel as if they have a relationship with you. And there's something quite intimate about podcasts. So I like that, because just today I was at lunch with my son and these 2 nice guys came up to me starting a company. And they were just incredibly friendly and really nice. And they kind of, it's almost like you're starting a conversation from letter D as opposed to letter A, because they feel as if they know you. So I find podcasts as a medium, the goodwill and the intimacy of the relationship, very rewarding.
Who do you listen to? I mean, what podcast does Scott Galloway listen to?
Oh, my stuff's pretty boring. I listen to The Daily from the New York Times. I'm a big fan of Sam Harris. I like his stuff a lot. I listen to history podcasts a lot. I think Lex Fridman, I've started listening to more of his. I go from different stuff. I'm obsessed with this guy named Dr. Peter Attia because I'm obsessed with health right now and longevity. I kind of skip around a lot.
No soccer podcasts? I mean, it seems like you must listen
to soccer
podcasts.
Right? No, my soccer podcast is my 12-year-old. He won't shut up about it. So I get about 6 hours of football podcasts every day.
You must see a lot of games. I mean, I think you wrote that somewhere recently that now you live in London, you attend like games live in the stadium quite a bit.
Oh, it's fantastic. As a matter of fact, we're planning to come to a Bayern Munich game at the Allianz Stadium, and you know, we watch a ton
Manchester
of football.
City. The Manchester City, the quarterfinal Champions League.
Yeah, it's gonna be huge. We're probably, I think, and not only that, we're planning a big trip to, I think it's the Euro finals in Germany next summer. We're planning a big trip down. We went to the World Cup. One of the, quite frankly, the highlights of moving to Europe has been football. We're football mad here.
And well, what's the team?
Well, I say it's the Glasgow Rangers because nobody's offended by that. in London, you have to be very careful about your team's allegiances. So my youngest loves Chelsea. My oldest likes the Spurs. I would say I'm probably an Arsenal fan, but the bottom line is I go to all the games and have a great time. I would just say I'm a huge fan. And my wife loves Bayern Munich. So, we've kind of got everything covered here. We just love the game and we probably go to 1 or 2 games a week.
The new Chelsea owner is a huge bond trader. I mean, he made his fortune with trading bonds. Did you know that? Do you know who he is? Todd Boehly,
yeah. He's a super impressive guy. I think he'll be a great owner. He's off to a rough start. But I think he's going to do great things. He did great things with the Dodgers. And I actually know him a little bit. And he strikes me as a really nice man who's really, like, not only into the team, but into the community. I think he's going to be a great owner. And I'm excited to have a quality American guy as an owner.
So will we see Scott Galloway as a soccer investor at some point?
I don't have that kind of money. It's like I'm wealthy, but not super wealthy. And I think you have to be in a different altitude to, unless it's like doing a Ronald Reynolds to go into a place like Wrexham.
But exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, no, I don't see that in my future.
All right. All right. Scott, thank you so much for being on the podcast once again. And, hopefully having you at the event or at another podcast soon.
Yeah, I absolutely love OMR. Congratulations on what you guys have built. I think it's just inspiring.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, brother.
Ich bin immer wieder überrascht, wie viele Menschen ich kenne, die sehr viel Energie stecken, natürlich in ihre Arbeit, in Hobbys, in Reisen, im Zweifel auch in Wohnraum. Und obwohl sie wissen, dass es langfristig keine gute Idee ist, ihre privaten Finanzen etwas schleifen lassen, ihre Finanzplanung nicht so im Fokus haben. Deswegen ist doch gut, dass es unseren Partner Liquid gibt. L-I-Q-I-D. Ich habe schon häufiger hier von Liquid erzählt. Die wollen eine maßgeschneiderte Anlagelösung sein mit einem persönlichen Ansprechpartner auf Augenhöhe für die Zielgruppe hier, zum Beispiel dieses Podcasts. Liquid möchte euch Zugang geben zu den besten Fonds im Bereich Venture Capital, zu den besten Fonds im Bereich Private Equity, in dem man als Privatperson sonst gar nicht reinkommt. Mit Liquid wäre das möglich. Am Ende ein digitaler Vermögensverwalter auf Family Office Niveau, Wealth Management für Leute, die vielleicht gar nicht so mega wealthy sind, aber trotzdem die ganzen Vorzüge genießen möchten. Liquid wurde zuletzt 5-mal in Folge als Deutschlands Top-Vermögensverwalter ausgezeichnet und bietet allen, die hier zuhören, ein kostenloses Kennenlernen, Orientierungs-, Erstgespräch. Einfach anmelden, kostet gar nichts unter liquid mit liquid.de/OMR. Link dazu natürlich auch in den Shownotes. Zurück zum Podcast.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.